All right, so now we are going to turn to item 7, which is going to be the review of the growth sub-portfolio. Rearrange my screen here a little bit. So I'm going to turn this over to Mr. Tim Price, the Chief Investment Officer. Tim, the floor is yours.
And I'm going to be joined by Mitch Taylor, our investment officer, who focuses on the public markets. I'm going to have him address what's been going on in the U.S. equity market a little bit later. But Mitch, if you could go ahead and share your screen, and there we go. Perfect. So for most of you, this is old hat here. We do an annual review of each one of the three functional sub-portfolios. Mitch, if you can go to slide 2. And for Dennis's sake, you know, this is something where we have a little bit deeper dive on how we structure each one of the sub-portfolios, how it's performing, what's going according to expectations, and where might some surprises have come from, and we discuss those. So the, go back to slide 2 real quick. So growth is our big dominant long-term exposure. This is about 3/4 of our target program. It's intended to fund future benefit payments. So contributions come into the liquidity program, benefit payments flow out of the liquidity program. Growth is sometimes rebalanced into the liquidity program, but this is intended to grow for 4 to 20+ years. So this is our long-term growth portfolio. And if you go to slide 3, So the main goals with this is really to capture global economics and earnings growth. This is our capital appreciation portfolio. So we're not necessarily focused on income streams, although we do like income where it is can be found. But this is meant for long-term capital appreciation, which means it's comprised of global stocks, private equity, private credit, real estate, et cetera. We do adjust the allocations between the individual asset classes based on, you know, valuation levels. Those tend to be tweaks rather than wholesale changes, but we do that annually. And the goal is for this to be remain invested for the long term. So we don't necessarily want to be forced sellers. So we had a period like the beginning of the pandemic, March of 2020. We want to be opportunistic buyers, not forced sellers out of this portfolio, which is why we have the liquidity and diversifying categories. Maybe we go to slide 4. While this is intended for long-term global growth, we have to be cognizant of how the short-term impacts that long-term number. So here's just some market returns, July of 2020 to July of 2021, and we see that remarkable snapback here. The global index up 33%, the U.S. equity S&P 500 up 34%. Anything that was a financial asset really, really took off over this time period here. A lot of that was predicated on stimulus, monetary and fiscal stimulus coming in, low rates really pushed folks into risk-seeking behaviors, and we saw that tremendous snapback in financial assets writ large. The only area that really didn't benefit as much, and we'll touch on this a little bit later in the presentation, is real estate. If you see that third from the bottom line there, this is basically operating properties. So not construction, up, leased, et cetera. And it's still up 7%, a very respectable number. But this is where we saw a little bit of a deviation between on-the-ground reality with the income streams from real estate and forward-looking expectations in the stock market. So returns expected to come much, much farther in the future or really bid up. That's why you see the growth index up 37%, where current income streams, which is really how real estate tends to be priced, suffered a bit. And that was, you know, there's some huge disparities within that, but real estate in general was not the strongest sector over the past year. So if we go to slide 5, Mitch. Our current asset allocation, we are pretty close to targets, which you would expect based upon the most recent rebalancing here. We tend to be slightly overweight to the non-US markets. We're still drawing down some of those legacy exposures there. And we're slightly underweight to private credit and real estate. And that's on private credit, you know, it's still a build out. We're getting closer and closer to the full build out. I think some of it is also a denominator effect because the public equity markets ran so far, so fast, and the private markets tend to get repriced more slowly. We'll see those that relative weight tick up over the next couple of quarters here, all else equal. Real estate is we paused the real estate program in 2020 until we could get some more clarity on what was going on with the COVID situation. We have relaunched that, and there will be some additional commitments coming up very shortly that it will report out probably next month. But we'll do a further review of real estate with Varis later on in the meeting. So slide six, Mitch. Just real quickly, you know, how did that market performance and our asset allocation translate to us? The growth portfolio was up 28.7% net over the past 12 months. And Trustee Holcomb, I see you have your hand up. You have a question there?
Yeah, I was wondering at what point, Tim, you may be making some comments on the Chinese situation and any exposure that we have. And my sense about China is that it's a command and control economy, and they're going to pick their winners and losers, and somebody's going to lose big time. So I'm nervous about that kind of exposure. Plus, the numbers that we're looking forward to, the forecast we're looking forward to on bonds, look pretty measly in the months, maybe even years to come. And I wonder if you could consider comments on both of those situations.
Sure. Happy to address that. I mean, we do touch on some of the risks going forward later in the presentation, but on China specifically, and if folks have seen some of the headlines, I think the Chinese regulatory environment has changed rather dramatically in the past year or so. Came up in some restrictions on basically online education programs, online gaming programs, and now on kind of some new restrictions on the leverage is allowed for developers. This is showing up in headlines for Evergrande, which is an enormous developer across China that's heavily, heavily indebted. They missed some coupon payments on Monday or yesterday, and they've got coupon payments due tomorrow. There's a big debate over whether the Chinese state is going to step in and work with Evergrande for a orderly deleveraging there or let it fail. That's injecting a lot of uncertainty into property developers in China. And then, you know, concerns about this becoming a contagion that spreads to the banks because China's Evergrande has borrowed from a lot of banks globally and onshore. I think from what I've been reading, the onshore or the mainland China investor is relatively comfortable that the Chinese state is going to allow for a orderly deleveraging. The offshore investors do not have the same level of confidence in the Chinese government, and we don't know which way that's going to shake out, but it's injected uncertainty into the market right now. And I think after a year where we're up 28.7%, you know, that is valuations have risen to the point where they can be supportive if everything goes right, but the market's going to get rattled when they start to see, you know, the potential for a policy misstep, for a failure in a heavily indebted investment, that sort of thing. It's not clear that that would result in contagion, but that is a concern right now. But and we'll touch on that again at the end of the presentation here. With your other comment on the bond market's really not represented within the growth portfolio, so I don't touch on it here. It's really focused in the liquidity program and a little bit in the diversifying program. But it, certainly the yields are at historic lows. And, I think Mitch is going to touch on what's going on with rates in his portion of the presentation as well. But let's go to slide seven. And we can see, you know, that those 1 year numbers are just shockingly large. For the most part, there has been a theme that private equity hasn't been able to keep up with the screaming returns of the domestic equity market, that started to reverse a little bit, where we're, you get those valuation lags are starting to be filtered into the private equity program, and the marks are coming up there. So we are seeing a 51% return as of the end of July for private equity. Again, real estate is the laggard here at 6%, still a respectable return, but nothing compared to what we've seen in the stock market. If we move out to the five-year number there, this starts to be kind of the time frame where we expect to see results from the growth program. We're up 11.8%, almost 12% in the growth program, which would be higher than we would normally expect to see it. Maybe we just go to slide. Just turn to the next slide, Mitch. Yeah. Hang on slide 8 for just a moment. Our first asset allocation study that we conducted with Verus was in 2015. So we thought it might be an interesting exercise to look at what our expectations were in 2015. These were 10-year forecasts. We're 5 years into that 10-year period. But just a little bit of a reality check here. And you can see this is a little bit busy here, but most of the asset classes performed roughly directionally in line with the Verus expectations. And then slide 9, please, Mitch. You can see, for international, developed, and emerging markets, which were some of the larger exposures there, came in fairly close to what the forecast would be. Forecast was 9.5% for developed markets, return 10.3. Forecast was 11.5% for emerging markets, return 13. The notable outliers here, and this is going to be a theme throughout here, is the outperformance of the domestic large cap market and domestic large cap growth in particular, relative to our expectations from 5 years ago. We've really seen the U.S. outperform relative to where we would have expected it to perform based upon valuations in 2015. Valuations have been extended and extended in the domestic large cap market. Conversely, within cash, we've seen the rates really kind of collapse down there. Part of this is the lowered rates because of the pandemic. And part of this was just we had an accommodative Fed even before the pandemic. And then we had an incredibly accommodative Fed over the past 18 months or so here. So slide 10, if you would. Thank you. On an absolute basis, we're tracking where we would expect to be in terms of growth assets. We did underperform the growth portfolio writ large, underperformed a global equity index. We still see underperformance within some of the areas we diversified into, including the private equity numbers, although they've had an incredible year, are still kind of recovering there. I think real estate has been impacted by the pandemic and certainly has not been accretive relative to the equity market. It has lowered the risk, and you see that results in the Sharpe ratio that's better than the index. So we're performing on a risk-adjusted basis much, much better. But on an absolute basis, not in line with the global equity index. Diversification, we think, still makes sense. But in an era where the global equity market is the clear winner, that diversification is going to take away somewhat. The diversification certainly helped us when we had the sell-off last year. And, I think we're following a smoother path, but when the equity market is screaming upwards, we should not expect the growth portfolio to keep up in that particular market environment. And then let's go to slide 11. This is just something interesting that we keep an eye on here. You see the one-year numbers. Again, these are all periods ending July. The one-year numbers for Cicera's growth portfolio versus that global equity benchmark. When the global equity benchmark has a really, really strong year, like 2017 or 2021, we're not going to keep up in those periods. But when there's a down year, like 2019, we expect to have some protection in there. But if we take a look at the rolling five-year numbers in the bottom half of the chart, having a five-year rolling returns of 11.8%, really in line with our expectations there. Again, didn't keep up with that strong global growth index return, but it was in keeping with our expectations. I think the Verus expectation in 2015 was this portion of the portfolio will return 8.8. We've returned 11.8%. You always have to take the forecast with a grain of salt, but at least we can see directionally correct there. Let's go to 12. I just want to touch base on private equity and real estate before I turn it over to Mitch to comment on the domestic equity market. You know, the private equity program, we're going to do a deep dive review with StepStone in November. So this will be brief, but, you know, I think that that strong recovery there, it's not even a recovery, just the strong valuation markups as we get into July of this year have been really great to see. One of the concerns we've had with private equity is just, it's been the darling asset class. It has raised an incredible amount of money. And you see all this dry powder that has yet to be deployed. And the concern is, you know, is this going to overheat the market? Well, if we go to slide 13, what we can see, thankfully, at least in the short term, is these valuations have started to tick down here. So we see that long upward trend line for, you know, the blue bars would be the global large buyouts, and the small and middle would be representing the green. And you see that long trend line up through the first quarter of the year. But if we take a look at the, you know, the past four quarters, we do see a little bit more of a moderation coming into some of these valuations. So that's giving us some comfort that the market is not overheating the way that it might have appeared to be based upon the dry powder alone. And if we go to slide 14, this is a phenomenon we're seeing in Europe as well as in the United States. So, you know, I think some comforting metrics here, but we'll do a deeper dive on this in 2 months. The other part I wanted to comment on slide 15 was real estate. And like I said, you know, this is not necessarily the most fun part of the portfolio to look at during COVID, but I think it is important to understand what's going on here. Really what we've seen with COVID is economic activity continuing by and large based upon the stimulus and the support from the federal government and from other central banks around the world. But we're seeing this huge spread in how offices, retail, multifamily, industrial, and hotels are being used or not used right now. And that's showing up in the valuations. We're also seeing suburbs outperforming the metro areas in a big reversal. So I think that, you know, you have seen, you know, certainly in our own backyards, we've seen what's going on with residential real estate, but there has been not an emptying of the metro areas, but a shift in usage. We're still not convinced that that's a permanent shift, but, you know, it is something to keep an eye on over this past 18 months or so. And we've really seen some of the alternative aspects of the real estate program start to outperform single family rentals, life sciences, data centers, cell towers, storage. This has really taken off, and you'll see that start to become more represented in the real estate portfolio going forward. But just to take a look at the deviations in performance on slide 16. This is an incredible chart over a relatively short time period here. Industrials shot up. So this would be warehouses, light manufacturing, that sort of thing. So I think this is benefiting obviously from the shift to online retail, to the extent there is onshoring of industrial, which is a small portion of this, but it's part of the story. That market segment has gone up dramatically. Now it is the much, much smaller than office, multifamily, retail, and hotel. But you see office kind of tick along. You know, I think a lot of these are 10 to 15 year leases and they don't roll off as quickly. Apartments, you know, shorter leases, but we still had a shortage of housing stock in the United States. So those have continued to tick up slightly. Retail, you know, I think COVID was the great accelerator of some of the trends towards pushing towards more online retail. And so we've seen the traditional retail sell off, but hotels where your lease rate is typically one night at a time have really just taken a beating here. And it is the core business district hotels that have really taken the most beating with the, you know, lack of conferences, lack of business travel. The more leisure oriented hotels went down, but have recovered rather nicely at this point. And with that, I think we're going to turn it over to Mitch. And I'd like Mitch to step through the domestic equity program. But before he does, let me just pause to see if there's any questions from the trustees.
I had a question, Tim, on the core real estate office. What's the future look like? Conundrum. You know, you hear a lot of different opinions about it, but I was struck by the sort of the uprising, and whether it be in Google or, you know, on the tech side, or in Goldman or any of the other large investment banks, where, you know, the edict was, hey, this has been great, we're returning to the office, and the uprising is, no, we're not. And it, so far, it seems to have, that pushback seems to have resulted in a, I don't want to call it a stalemate, but a rollback of the idea that we're just going to simply go back into Midtown and life is good. And I'm wondering, how do you handicap that looking out 3 and 5 years about what's going to happen?
Yeah, very cloudy crystal ball right now. What we have seen is the lease activity, at least in New York City, which tends to be kind of where we're tend to be a little bit more overexposed there, has really kind of flatlined. We saw a cessation of leasing activity, and now it's kind of recovered and just into kind of a quiet zone. It's been interesting to watch the headlines tend to come from, as you say, the investment banks or the financial institutions in general, and then the tech companies in general. And the trend really has been, for the most part, New York City went back to work. And, you know, we do track a couple of metrics on this, and it's, you know, we track the subway turnstile activity in New York City to see what's going on. There is a new kind of fun index. It's called the Pret Index. There's a sandwich shop called Pret-a-Manger. They put out their monthly sales. And this tends to be kind of the grab a quick lunch and go back to your office in the financial sectors. That's been trending up. Yesterday, there was a headline that Google just bought a $2 billion office building in Hudson Yards in New York City. So I think, you know, we're starting to see green shoots on the office front. But, you know, it's, we're treading very cautiously there. So I would say, to the extent we're working with managers who are heavy in office, we want to see that it's differentiated office, because I think the generic office space is going to be a little bit tough. And when I say differentiated, I'm probably talking, you know, a tech campus, something with outdoor amenities, something with an easy commute. Those would be the, you know, the properties we're looking for, rather than the, you know, more generic class B, at least in San Francisco and New York. Those are a little bit tougher sell. But, you know, as is the case with all real estate, it's, you know, location, location, location. And Texas office space is still trading and still fully occupied. Florida office space still trading, fully occupied. So it's, we're, you know, I think we're probably another year away from having great clarity on what the long-term impact is on office in particular. I do think, you know, the core business district hotel is probably going to come back, but they're not going to come back at the same valuations. If you think about conference attendance, I would say, you know, looking forward, most business travel experts are saying probably a 35% reduction in business travel going forward is the net impact from us having all spent 18 months on Zoom and being more comfortable there. So those could be a little bit more of a tougher sled.
Excellent. Thank you. John.
I had two quick REIT questions. Well, ask you to react to mortgage REITs and malls. We're not specifically describing either one. Malls, I guess, could fit in retail. Are those areas that we're have looked at or considering looking at? I know mortgage comes under its own category, but would you comment on that?
Sure, happy to. Mortgage REITs are not something we've been focused on. So our REIT exposure with Adelante is more in the equity REIT space. So that's not been an area of focus. I probably couldn't comment on that in any intelligent way. I don't have good firsthand current data in that space. The malls, you know, it's kind of a tale of two stories there. If you have an outdoor mall with a lot of restaurants, you're probably doing okay. If you have a traditional 80s, 90s indoor mall, those are really tough. And thankfully, we don't have a lot of exposure in that space. But, you know, in Concord here, the difference between Sun Valley Mall and the new mall that went up on the old Chevron site there, it's rather dramatic in terms of foot traffic and I would assume sales as well. But it is outdoor retail is doing okay. Indoor retail is suffering dramatically.
Kim, just to kind of add on to that point, it seems to me that the issue with malls though certainly predates COVID, and that decline was already well going on. You know, back to 2015, 14, it was starting, right?
It was. I think this is the acceleration point here. The trend that was already in place, you know. I've been reading about the death of the mall for the better part of 15 years, and it's a very long, slow death, but this did accelerate it. So, I mean, now we're starting to hear folks talk about rezoning these, repurposing the malls as industrial or warehouse space, repurposing them perhaps as multifamily. We're not seeing a lot of transactions specifically with the rezoning and purpose, but we're hearing a lot more, I guess, conversations around it. And, as you well know, rezoning is a long and laborious process, but I think some of the lack of housing is probably going to mean that some of these urban and suburban malls transition to multifamily. I think the outlying area malls have a tougher future in front of them. Those might get knocked down and repurposed as industrial. We've seen some demand from Amazon, but it's still cheaper to build on a flat piece of land on, you know, an exurb than it is to knock down a mall and put up a warehouse. But we don't have great clarity on some of those Class B malls, and we're not very exposed to them either.
That's a good thing.
Yes. All right. So let me turn to Mitch and have him kind of step through what's going on with the U.S. equity market, which has been kind of the big story over the past year here.
All right.
And Mitch, we can't see you or hear you.
Yeah, he is muted as well as doesn't have his camera on, but now he's unmuted.
Okay. Well, you can hear me now. I'm not sure why my camera is not on. I've got the lens open, but
do you have the video button clicked on Zoom on the bottom there?
Video button clicked on Zoom. There we go.
There you are.
Okay, sorry about that. So we're going to move on to the U.S. equity market over the next few slides. And the reason for that is, first, in December, you all approved an increased allocation to the asset class, a significant one. And second, U.S. equities have really outperformed all other markets. And third, there's been unprecedented amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus there, which has improved performance, but also creates the potential for disruption. I'm going to talk just briefly through some of these themes, the equity return drivers, and then graphically illustrate them. The V-shaped recovery is very much in evidence. This was a big controversy at the beginning of COVID, but we've seen it. And the consensus is we're going to continue to have a strong GDP. We're looking at 4.3% is the current consensus for 2022. Extremely strong. We've obviously seen increased vaccination rates and emerging variants, but those seem to have had very little impact on markets. Rates are very low still. We've had a few moments of volatility, but these low rates have persisted, and they definitely drive asset prices across any cash flowing asset. the unprecedented physical stimulus is not only out there, but there's more to come. There's a lot of excess liquidity. And this, we have a slide following up, is really the dry powder to equity markets. The S&P has recorded 54 new highs year to date, which is amazing. And it's also, multiples are in the 90th percentile range. This makes equity markets really susceptible to any disruption and to any kind of unanticipated shocks or earnings disappointments. The valuations are highly dependent on earnings and sales growth. There's also been a lot of distortion in terms of very low rated equity because the retail investor has had access to leverage and used it in an unprecedented way. You've had a lot of stocks that have increased volatility in markets. These are the so-called meme stocks, AMCs of the world. So this is an interesting, this shows you the V-shaped recovery. It's quite obvious. We are now above pre-pandemic levels in GDP in terms of inflation-adjusted dollars. This is the surge in the Delta variant. It's also obviously very significant. And here we have the U.S. Treasuries. We had this slight blip where people were a little afraid of inflation and a Fed misstep. Today, we're back to pretty low numbers at 1.31. This slide is a few weeks old, but that number is unchanged. And this is a very unusual aspect of our recovery because of the physical stimulus in terms of checks to individuals. We have disposable income for the U.S. consumer up. That's a large deviation from any downturn I've ever seen. And this is the so-called, what I would call the so-called dry powder to equity markets. This is the money market funds in the U.S. You can see that they were kind of moving up pre-pandemic, and then they just had this huge jump. That's largely panic selling in equity markets. And now we've seen it drop. There's still a lot of room to roll. And this essentially can be a fuel to equity prices and very supportive of equity prices. And here you see year to date, 54 new highs. This is really the classic climbing the wall of worry. Nothing has really stopped it. It just keeps going up, up, up. So we're off a little bit from this number. We're down about 3%. And we talked a little bit about China. That seems to be, you know, the main cause of worry, that you could have some kind of Lehman moment and you could move into across the world. You could have a drop not only in the Chinese equity markets, but potentially growth impacted elsewhere. So here's the good news about the equity drivers. The fundamentals are incredibly strong. There's strong earnings growth. There's strong sales growth. There's strong margins. The balance sheets are incredibly strong. We've actually delevered over this time period. And the earlier question about bonds, this shows you what is really underpinning the strength in the investment grade and in high yield. If you have a margin of safety and a strong balance sheet, defaults will be lower. And that's a huge driver of how you price a bond. The valuation, the consensus is in, you know, kind of a reasonable number. The forward PE is 20.5. That's actually below 2019's level. But again, this is completely dependent upon achieving the target sales growth, right, and GDP. There's also this kind of technical driver, TINA, there is no alternative. And when you can't get any money in rates or in bonds, you move to equities. So we have a significant exposure to small cap. It has performed really well in the last 12 months. It has lagged a bit over the last 2 years, but we are committed to the asset class. The academic research really supports the small cap premium. And, you know, it's proven to be to perform over time. So we presented this industry scorecard in 2020, and it really shows who the winners and losers were. And you know, you see a wide dispersion, and you see fear-based type assets really performing well, and also kind of the lockdown performing assets performing well. And this would be gold and the internet stocks. And then you move forward a year, you know, and the losers become winners as we rotate into a more cyclical economy, and you see steel, real estate, construction outperforming. The interesting thing here, I think, is that food retail and trucking performed well in both years. And then we just like to take a moment and kind of revisit our outlook from 2020. You know, the Fed was really committed to lower rates, and they were not even thinking about raising rates. And now we see the market is, they're going to be very data dependent. The market is, they've communicated well to the market, and the market is reacting very positively. They have pretty much hit the inflation target, and there's substantial progress on the unemployment level. Financial repression is still evident, and all things being equal, this just increases risk-taking on the part of investors. Disinflation, we didn't have any deflation. That's the good news. We don't really know where things are going forward, but I think the consensus is we're going to have return to a low inflationary environment. Deglobalization seemed very much in play. People and companies are rerouting supply chains, and that has happened to a degree. However, I believe, and I think the consensus is that's really on the margins, and we're going to return to a global economy. The second wave hit, now we're in wave three or four. And in terms of trade, the tariffs remain in place. The Trump tariffs remain in place. That's not highlighted much, but they do remain in place. There's been a lot of issues around China's regulatory environment. You know, even before Evergrande, we had a really weak performance in the LTM in the Asian markets. And, you know, they entered COVID first, came out first. So that's part of it. But there's also a lot of regulatory environment across the board. You probably read about the ADRs and how China is kind of pulling the brakes on issuance in the U.S. So that's a story that I think that is evolving. It's hard to get a good handle on it. To the earlier questions about China, I think it's, you know, something we're definitely watching. We have exposure through some of our global accounts, or, you know, our global strategies, notably First Eagle. They are viewing this, you know, in kind of two ways, cautiously optimistic, potentially choosing their spots and being opportunistic. I mean, the one thing you have to keep in mind, despite a lot of the issues we bring up about China, it is one of the fastest growing part of the global economy. With that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
So I had a question while others are thinking about theirs that really goes back a few slides, but I think I can describe it for you, which is at what point would we be able to assess the effect of the cessation of unemployment benefits being the cash driver for so many people? I mean, the stories are anecdotal, but I heard them all summer long, every time I went somewhere, about a business telling me that they couldn't hire anybody, literally couldn't get people in. They were working part-time hours. I talked to restaurant owners who said they've had to shut down mid-shift. They've had to curtail reservations so that because they couldn't find people, the working thought or premise was that there's so much economic benefit flowing through unemployment that it's a disincentive to work. Popular talking point, I know that it got bandied about, but it seems to be true. And the question is, since I understood recently that this is the last month of the federal unemployment benefit enhancement, what's the time frame that you would look at to see what effect that's had and what that means in terms of, you know, particularly the equity markets.
Yeah, I think it's a, as Tim said, a cloudy crystal ball, but I think you can assume that you'd be looking at it over like the next year. That's kind of the time frame I think about as it flows through. I also think that it's definitely going to flow through, and we're going to have lower growth rates again, not immediately, but 18 months, 24 months out, I think you're going to have that impact. I think there are some, this is my opinion, but I've heard others say it, there are some persistent impacts from the COVID pandemic that will definitely impact a lot of industries. I certainly, you know, Tim brought up that 35% decline in central yeah. business district hotels. That's an astonishing number. So.
Okay. I had two quick questions. One, you didn't mention at all crypto. Is there any role for crypto with our monies? And the second is the impact of passing versus not passing this $3.5 trillion quasi-infrastructure bill.
I'll start with the infrastructure. I mean, that's obviously a very big number. So that would continue to support the economy and flow through in a variety of ways. Crypto, I'll quickly give my opinion, then defer to Tim. I don't believe there's a role for crypto in our plan. And I've done a lot of work on it. There are plans that are involved. I'm surprised to say that there are. And I've, you know, a recent conference call we had with CalPERS, there were several local plans that were involved. I just think that it doesn't really fit, and I could go into a lot of detail about this, it doesn't really fit the traditional asset. It's also, if you think specifically about Bitcoin, it's heavily controlled by few players, which is not really a good transparent market in my view. So and I'll let Tim give his thoughts on crypto.
Yeah, I mean, crypto is obviously interesting. And, you know, I think it's been something we keep revisiting every 6 months to say, what's new? And is there something new there? I mean, it's gone from a currency to an asset to a hedge to digital gold. And I think part of that ongoing conversation is what's keeping us out. Because the open question is, what is it? How do you use it? And what's the fundamental value of this thing? So if it's a currency, we typically don't engage in currency trading. That's not something our managers are skilled at. It's not something that we have taken an active view on. If it's an asset or a commodity, again, we don't have a whole lot of exposure to commodities. It's not something that we focus on in the portfolio. But I think the biggest thing that keeps me on the sidelines with crypto is the regulatory environment. Now, if the SEC decides to firm up the regulatory environment or another agency decides to firm up the regulatory environment, we're going to have a more concrete view. But right now, you know, we have the CEO of Coinbase, which is an online crypto exchange, going on a rant on Twitter about how the SEC is selectively enforcing rules against him about what a security is. And he didn't seem to understand that a lending asset created a security. When that's the environment that we're in, that's not an asset class that I'm comfortable being directly exposed to. And it's just, you know, I think we think there might be something there, but we haven't got a firm enough regulatory environment to really make an assessment at this point.
Jay Kwan, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah, just a point to agree largely with the uninvestability of crypto at this point on an institutional basis. But I would remind, I think, everybody that crypto isn't necessarily just the coin or the token. There's this whole kind of, you know, decentralized finance wave going on there. And I'm sure there are parts of the plan that are invested in one way or another in, you know, kind of that, call it digital revolution or shaking up of how finance is normally done I point out in one aspect, there's this idea of the stable coin, right? That takes money, invests it in a kind of dollar for dollar, supposedly. It matches up to Mitch's chart on the huge money market balances. And there's a potential linkage for disruption in our actual economy from this crypto kind of crazy crypto world.
Yeah.
But I think I had one real question, though, that that slide 24, that climbing the wall of worry, as you called it, that was just amazing. Really, the U.S. equity performance over the past time period there, if that's not a straight line, I'm not sure what is. But it's super, at the same time, it's got to be super worrying, right? you just got this, like, I mean, that's literally a straight line. So what that's meant for the plan is obviously great returns, but very low plan volatility of the investment portfolio. What's that look like in terms of you know, actuarial effects for us, right? You have is low sponsor contribution volatility. So people kind of, maybe they get lulled into a sense of, oh, 90 something percent funded, things are consistent year to year. It's all built on this idea that, okay, valuations are rising, the Fed's going to taper in a little bit potentially. There's all kinds of market turn events going on. And oh, by the way, we're kind of ticking up the risk level of the plan at the same time. So it just, you know, it's not, I mean, we're at a great spot, I think, obviously. But I just wanted to kind of remind folks that, hey, you don't get here for free, right? There's potential for vol. There's potential for larger swings, you know, we just have to expect that there's something to come.
Yeah.
So before Tim comments on that, I like many of you, when you're out and about or you have social interactions, are invariably talked to by current members of the system or retirees who want to know how Sisera is doing. They read all of the CalSTRS, CalPERS headline, you know, equity runaway rates of return. And it gives me the opportunity to explain to them a little bit how we're built and that our overall rate of return was X even in this phenomenal equity market, and that we're built to, capture as much of the upside as we can, but we're also built to try to capture less of the downside when winter comes. And to your point, Jay, so that's my lead into saying 5 or 6 years ago, or whenever it was we first started talking about strategic planning and moving to the fully functional portfolio, I will tell you now, I was certain at that time that by now we would have had a pretty serious adjustment after the bull market run that started in 2010, maybe 2009, but certainly in 2010. And yeah, we saw, you know, that V there is pretty notable. And I lost a bet on that about how quickly we'd recover from that. But that aside, I can tell you back in 15, when we started looking at the strategic allocation shift to the FFP, I fully anticipated by now we would have had not a 2008 crisis, but a pretty significant downturn in the traditional business cycle sense. And it hasn't happened. So I look at this and I got my eyes wide open, at least to this for one trustee, and say, this has been an incredible, crazy, remarkable run through COVID, through all of this that I couldn't have foreseen. But on the other hand, I still have the comfort of knowing that we're built for when the downturn occurs, because if we function as we're designed, we'll capture less of the downside in any way. So that's a perspective, Jay, from somebody who was around when the decisions were made to shift into what we have now. And notwithstanding that pretty incredible 30% line that goes up at that dramatic angle, I think even with that pause, you have to take, when you look at those numbers, that we can take some comfort in how we're built. Anyway, I'll stop talking there, but Jerry, you had your hand up.
As long as we're going back on the slides just a little bit, slide 19 is just, I find absolutely fascinating, because one of the words that I'm less enthralled with at all times these days is consensus. I'm looking for a consensus amongst healthcare professionals about what we're doing with boosters, and I don't think that exists. And the consensus at the time amongst a number of individuals, supposed economic, you know, gurus, was that a V-shaped recovery was impossible. It was not going to happen. And don't even think about it. And it's an amazing picture. And it was a largely political position that was being taken at the time by economists, but it's just that more of this consensus. And I'm reminded of that old line about what I used to say it in the dental world, but it's true of a lot of other worlds. The only thing you can get two dentists to agree on is how much a third should give to charity. And I think there's some truth to that amongst economists and other professionals too, because this V-shaped recovery was never supposed to happen. And there it is.
There it is. I lost it. Like I said, I lost a friendly bet. Dennis, you had a comment.
I want to see if you, somebody can comment on the current political environment and standoff regarding the raising of a debt limit. And I know nobody truly believes that U.S. Yeah. Can actually default on the debt. But in the last few years, I think it showed us that at this point, nothing is impossible. So I just wanted to see if anybody can comment on that.
Sure. You know, I think the fact that we have these debates every couple of years is probably not the proudest point in American politics. These tend to be kind of standoffish things, and they get resolved at the last second. You know, my concern is largely that when a market is positioned like this, when the market has been so supported by fiscal and monetary stimulus, and valuations are this stretched, you know, anything can tip it over. And if it's just, you know, the debate over the debt ceiling, you know, an infrastructure bill, Evergrande in China, you tend to have an environment where if everything goes right, the valuations are supportive. And if one or two things at the significant scale go wrong, you're in for a world of hurt. And so I do think the political environment remains stressed. I think, it's always strange to me to have this conversation, but the U.S. Treasury Secretary is allowed to go to the U.S. Mint and mint a coin of any denomination and theoretically continue paying the debts. So if they mint a $1 trillion platinum coin, I mean, it's like the out, but again, it's like these aren't logical solutions. These aren't rational solutions, but they are possible solutions. I do think there's a lot of saber rattling around the debt limit every time it comes up, and it seems to get resolved pretty much every time. So I'm not necessarily putting it off my list of risks, but it's a little bit lower down for me.
All right. Thank you, Tim.
Any idea with respect to the impact of demographics going forward? I mean, we've lost close to 700,000 lives. And is there a potential long-term impact of that?
So when we take a look at demographic trends, we tend to be focused on the number of available workers and the number of retirees to a lesser extent here. So from the stock market perspective, you're focused on people kind of aged 25 to 54. That's really what they've considered kind of the prime working age. That tends to be the bulk of the drivers for labor availability here. And, you know, to the extent that that population segment has had a lesser impact from COVID, it has a less direct impact on labor force participation. So, you know, the impact of COVID is not necessarily on the economy going forward. You know, is the lives lost are tragic, but it's not the way the stock market tends to value the labor force. You know, that segment of the population had lower death rates overall, at least to date. Obviously, we're not done with the pandemic. We're still in it. But, you know, in terms of demographic trends, I think, again, we see this as the great accelerator. So it's not necessarily accelerating in terms of lives lost, but it's in terms of early retirements, which we're seeing that acceleration moving through here. You know, Scott had the comment on the difficulty in hiring. And, you know, I'd say the jury's out on the actual cause. I think, as with most of these things, there's a lot of different things overlapping simultaneously. So it's, you had more support in terms of expanded unemployment benefits. You had local and state support systems, but you also have, you know, we look at the trends and we see a lot more women have left the workforce than men, and the difficulty around childcare, which is very, very real, is a big chunk of that. So we have a demographic trend of fewer women in the workforce. But then on the other side, we have a Fed Reserve who said, we're going to keep rates lower for longer. We want to see improvements in these unemployment rates. We want to see labor force participation come back up. So we've got some countervailing forces there. And in the short term, I think, you know, the demographic trend is really driven by the early retirement. And candidly, some of that is just folks reexamining what they want to do with their lives. And this is a time to take stock. There is a philosophical element to this, whether that's leaving the workforce, changing jobs, changing industries. You know, we see labor mobility is up dramatically, really since the beginning of the year. And a lot in that younger portion of the demographic. But we've always had this, we've had this trend for a long period of time where we're going to have the baby boomers retire, folks go into drawdown mode. The concern was that, you know, what kind of pressure would that put on the stock market? To date, none, you know, honestly. And, you know, I think we're focused on more of the what's going on with the millennial generation and their labor participation. You know, they're the biggest chunk of the labor force right now. And what are the trends going there? And right now it's very noisy because you're seeing a lot of that labor mobility. So we're waiting to see that calm down and say, like, okay, do we see a permanent trend or is this just a lot of pent up reaction to the past 18 months?
Well said.
Thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Sure. And maybe just in the interest of time, we can go to slide 30 and I'll just kind of wrap up my comments here. And again, happy to take any more questions, but I want to make sure we stay on time here. So looking forward, you know, what's going in our favor? The fiscal and monetary stimulus is unprecedented in a post-war era. The Federal Reserve has never been this dominant in kind of the market. It really creates a strong bid for the financial assets. As Mitch touched on, GDP growth, although it's come down a bit, is still looking quite strong. And, you know, I think we need to be cognizant that there is, as Jerry said, you know, that's a consensus number, and then we can have some outliers around that. But, you know, the path forward is generally looking quite good, at least for the United States. Europe, a little less so. And the low rates really are pushing the risk-taking behavior. So, you know, inflation is low. It's ticking up, but it's still low by historical standards. And that's pushing folks into longer duration growth equities. And then, you know, as I mentioned, the Federal Reserve moving to this average inflation targeting. So they want 2% on average rather than 2% as a place to raise rates and tap the brakes. That's a different, you know, regime there. So that's all supportive of where we are in risk-seeking assets. Well, let's take a look at the other side.
Tim, yep. Just for 1 second, could you comment on at least what your perspective might be about inflation? You know, once again, we've got this big group and we know where they are that are saying, temporary. It's just going to be a little summer blip. Don't worry about it. And you've got the other side that's saying, oh, yeah, want to bet. And the want to bets are beginning to look like they're they're making the case, and it's a temporary thing, are kind of like the people that on board the Titanic that said, not to worry, we're just stopping to pick up ice. So where do you come down on this?
I'd say I'm still in the camp that says it looks like a lot of this is supply shock related that should get resolved. But the fact that, you know, we start to see a tick up in the owner equivalent rent portion of the inflation number, that's where we start to get concerned. So if we're seeing, you know, hotel rates come up, yeah, they're at a low, they're going to come back up. Used car prices shot up, rental car prices shot up. Again, those are all temporary, but when we start to see the owner adjusted rent or owner equivalent rent portion come up, that is the stickier portion of inflation. So I'd say I'm still in the camp that says this is probably a 1 to 2 year phenomenon, and then we're back to a lower inflation camp. But that's kind of, I would say that's my 65% probability. My 35% probability is, boy, if the labor force is materially changed and we do onshoring of manufacturing assets, and we've got the Federal Reserve who may have used up a lot of their tools, that could be, you know, an environment for inflation or stagflation. We always have to take a probability approach here, but I would say the transitory is still dominant, but declining.
If your horizon is maybe 1 to 2 years, then there's one Democratic Party that's going to be in feeling pretty bad about this, because if it's still there, still climbing, or hasn't gone down much by election season next year, they're going to have a problem.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So let's go to, take a look at more of the headwinds here. The number one headwind is really the first bullet point. Everything else is a derivative of that. The valuations are, you know, we had the saying back in the late 90s that the market was priced for perfection. We're not quite there yet. We're not at the 99th percentile, but we're at the 90th percentile. Earnings growth, sales growth, consumer spending have got to be, on these strong trend lines to support those valuations and really allow the market to grow into those valuations and kind of lower the PE ratio a little bit. But we really don't see a whole lot of room for the PE to expand beyond where it is. It's up close to, I think we said 26.9. The market's come back a bit, so it's just a little bit below that. But a PE ratio that extended does not leave a whole lot of room to grow. So it's got to be growth dependent. The low global rates are distortionary. So the negative rates in Europe and the low rates in the United States, this really creates some disruptions in normal, quote unquote, normal historical pricing in risk assets. The inflation uncertainty is a bigger and bigger piece of this. If it truly is a supply shock driven inflation, that should be able to get resolved. If it's not, the concern is the Fed has used a lot of their tools and has fewer tools at their disposal going forward. And I think we need to have the humility to say that we've never seen this level of government support for the markets. So we haven't seen the scenario, and we need to be aware that we're in uncharted territory here. And I think that just calls for a bit of humility. We still want to allow the asset allocation to do its work long-term. We don't have a reason not to trust that, but I think we need to be cognizant that, we haven't seen this before, and we need to be very, very watchful of the market and how that's filtering in. And then lastly, geopolitical risk. Things have not gotten better between the US and China. We're having, seeing the effects of COVID globally. I think the adverse climate events have been, a challenge as well. And certainly that's showing up in insurance and reinsurance rates. But with that, Mitch, if you go to slide 32, we always try to bring in an investment manager to kind of highlight their role in the program. And we have Emerald Advisors joining us on the next agenda item. Just real quickly on Emerald, we're going to have the entire portfolio management team. This is our small cap growth asset management firm. We've had them since 2003, I believe. So it's a long-term manager. But I think it's helpful to especially in a market environment where the story has been large companies dominating. Sometimes the small company story gets a little bit lost in the shuffle, and we thought it might be a good time for them to come in and just kind of highlight for us what they're seeing in their area of the market and how that's flowing through to the results of Cicero's overall growth program. But before we bring in Emerald, just happy to take any other trustee comments or questions.
Any other questions or comments for Tim before we move on to agenda item 8? I'm not seeing any, Tim, so thank you. Absolutely. That was very interesting to you and Mitch both. That was quite an interesting discussion. If anybody has time on the crypto issue before we move on, take a look at John Paulson's interview with David Rubenstein on crypto. It's kind of entertaining. Tells you John Paulson's view.